Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help.
Hello and welcome to Real Recovery. I'm awfully glad you decided to join us tonight. If you are joining us on purpose or by accident, either way, we're very excited that you found us. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio and just across the way on the other side of the chicken wire fence, George P. Fraser. George, good evening.
Billy, how are you tonight?
I'm good.
It's a nice night tonight.
It's a beautiful night. And you know what, George, I have to say we have so many people that say, I listen to Real Recovery, and I don't have an addiction myself, but I do know someone who does. And they'd love the stories of redemption. And last week we had Dr. Bob Coates on, and we talked about that, and it was great, and we wanted to sort of carry on the theme for another week about what it's like to be living with someone with an addiction. It throws out a very wide net for listeners.
Everybody knows somebody.
Yes.
If it's not you, there's a family member. When people ask me what I do, and I tell them—
What do you say? I'm curious myself.
I lie.
You have to lie.
You know, I'm a retired professional athlete.
Really?
I sure, that's
that.
Why I hang around the health club all day.
I
need some
new
gold chains, you know, and a couple warm-ups.
You need more gold chains. You have
four
on right now.
But no, whenever anybody, and I tell them that I'm an addiction counselor, can't even say it. You know, the word work kind of freaks me out a little bit. Yeah.
Do you have a check stub that indicates that you're—
No.
Okay.
No. I don't have a bank or anything now. Sit in my chair all day, watch TV.
Yeah.
It's a great life.
It's not a bad
promises
life.
Are coming true. Anyway, where was I? ADD moment.
Doesn't
just
matter.
Gone.
Doesn't matter. We know we're talking about people know someone who has an addiction.
Everybody does. And they're glad to talk about it. One of the things that addiction does, it allows people to get to their inner core of where they're really at. If it's real close to you, you're going to get to know God.
Mm-hmm. And if it's a spouse or a child, your stakes are as high as they can be.
Yeah. I'm in recovery myself. That was hard enough. But with somebody else, you just sit back and watch. And you need to take care of yourself. And one of the best things we heard was Bob last week is meeting with other like-minded people who are going through the same thing, because you're not alone here, and you can find those people. Bob was talking about that, you know, the friends and family group that he goes to, 39 years. I was getting up there. I was close.
Yeah.
You just jumped in too quick. I was 37, 38, and you said 39. And he still goes. And why? Because it works.
Mm-hmm. When you look at an alcoholic, an addict, a drug addict in the family, they hijack the narrative of the family. They now become the center of attention, and all energy gets usually taken out of the family to address the person who is the addict. Right, George?
Well, I think I'd be the center of attention anyway. Sounds like we got some resentments going over there.
In your case, you would be the center of attention.
We need counseling in here, Arnold.
Although there'd be very few people in the room.
We need counseling in here.
Yeah. I'm not surprised. Counselor would be good.
It would be good.
We should get some of our counselor guests back in.
Absolutely. There's collateral damage. And we say that when somebody gets sober, you're going to affect 10 to 20 lives by your recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same if you don't. And it's sad. And frankly, most people don't get sober. And so you can sit around and wait for them to get help, or you can help yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's your choice. And the good news is if you do that, you're going to find a deeper walk with God that'll help you cope. And it's not easy, and it could be really sad. People die every day, and it's tragic. It seems so unnecessary to me, Bill. Even though I'm in recovery, it's like, how did we get here? Nobody, when they're 10 years old, says, you know, I'm going to become a cocaine addict and destroy everybody in my way. But that's what happens. And Satan roars around like a lion looking for somebody to devour. And the only place you can go is God. You might stop that behavior, Bill, but if you don't work on changing your heart, which you can't do, but God can will if you let him, you're going to be a train wreck even if you're not using. The only way to get at the core, the Blue Recovery book says our drinking is but a symptom.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is egocentrism and self-centeredness. things I could write a book about, you know, yeah. one of my strong suits. But if you don't address who you are, and if you're not the person who's the addict, you're going to get hurt at your core. And you need to get God's help on how you're supposed to walk, because he allowed this.
Mm-hmm.
If he's sovereign, Bill, he allowed this to happen. So acceptance and then doing our part is the call.
Yeah. George, let's talk about step 10 tonight. We always like to cover a step before we bring on our guest, Barb Roos. She's got quite a story living with her husband who struggled with alcoholism and still does.
Mm.
To this day, she's been an author. She's written a blog. She's written a couple of books. I'm Waiting God is one of them. Another one is called The Worry Battle. So she's really processed this well.
Nice.
Yeah. And let's
look at step 10. Yeah, where we continue to take our personal inventory, and when we're wrong, we promptly admit it. One of the things that I've learned on this show was when Dr. Glenn Pickering was on, and he talked about addicts and alcoholics that he's worked with in his private practice. In working this step that we admit when we're wrong, it doesn't mean we're bad when we're wrong. Bill, that was really freeing for me, and I know a lot of the people that I work with and guys that I know that are in recovery, we always want to defend ourselves when we're wrong because we're used to being wrong as being bad, and it's not. It means you're wrong. Now, you can do things that are bad, but if you can look at it as being wrong and you try to make it right with God's help, it gives you the freedom to go, hey, I blew that. Let's get back on the beam. Let's get back walking with God. We call it repentance, that we've missed the mark. We've sinned. I want to confess it to Christ and restore me so I can walk with you again. Because the longer you hang out, the longer you fight it, you defend it, you justify it, you minimize it, you're walking farther and farther away from God. It's not going to end well.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to encourage you tonight, as you're even listening to this program, and we're going to go to break in about a minute, is I want you to already get into a spirit of prayer, because you have to get your heart ready for the work that's ahead. I don't want to make it sound too ominous. I don't even know what that word means, but
it's a good one.
It's a good word.
It's a party killer.
It is. It is. But I want you to keep prayer real, keep it going, and keep it you know, as close to your heart as you can, and ask God for help that you need tonight. And then when Barb comes on, she'll tell you her story, how she coped, and I think you're going to be encouraged.
It's going to be a great show, Bill.
Yeah, yep. So you're listening to Real Recovery, Bill and George, Ted at the board. So we're going to take a little break, and then when we come back, we're going to bring on our special guest, Barb Roos. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to the show. So nice to be having our guest, Barb Roos, on the program tonight. George, we had an opportunity last week to talk about living with someone who has an addiction. And I think there is a tremendous interest in people hearing stories of how others have weathered the storm, because a lot of people living with people in addiction.
Absolutely. And Dr. Bob Coates last week was a fabulous show. I know I learned a lot, Bill.
Yeah. So let's welcome to the show, Barb Roos. Hello, Barb. How are you?
Hello. I'm happy to be here, gentlemen. Glad we get to talk.
Yeah, likewise. Likewise. So, you know, always want to hear your journey, and you can start us where you're most comfortable.
Well, I believe that perhaps the beginning, just for some context, I did not grow up in a home that was affected by addiction or abuse. I've become a big fan of the ACE test, the Adverse Childhood Experience test, that's been out there for a few decades. Some of my earliest memories are issues that we had to deal with, issues of race. I grew up in an African-American household, but not with addiction or abuse. But we lived in an apartment building, and my dad's brother lived above us with his wife and his kids. And I do have memories of my dad going upstairs to their apartment because I would hear yelling and things thrown in glass. But it would be years later before I put two and two together and realized that my uncle was an alcoholic. And eventually my aunt moved my cousins out of state away. But it wasn't anything that our family talked about. But those memories stuck with me. For me, I mean, I did the whole standard American thing. Went to high school, went off to college, met a boy. He was real cute. And we got married, and we got married young. We finished college. We got jobs. We had a couple of kids and the ups and downs. But we both had great careers, and we were doing well. And our life seemed to be chugging along up and to the right. We had a church. We did small group, we volunteered, like all of the things. And I didn't really think anything about addiction. My husband, he knew he had to be careful with alcohol, but it wasn't, I didn't understand the bigger picture. He just had made a decision not to keep it in the house. His dad was an alcoholic, and we weren't big partiers or anything in college, but he just said, I don't think I should keep it in the house. I don't want to start a habit. And I thought, well, that's great. Those are good boundaries. And it was always something that was kind of this dark shadow in the background, but our lives were going so well that it really just didn't come up that often. Like maybe once a year you go to a party, and it was never where there was this dramatic event where there was something earth-shattering that happened. It was more like, this feels awkward. Do we need to talk about this? So that's kind of where my story really began. And then it was about 2008 when I realized that things were starting to come apart at the seams.
You know, Barb, when you mention things like, boy, is this something we should talk about it? Do you feel like that ship had already set sail? Like it was already too late?
No, not back then.
Go good.
No, not back then. What I know now that I didn't know then was that he grew up in a family where it was never talked about. I grew up in a household where it wasn't perfect, but my parents, particularly my dad, he liked to take on head on things. Now, for context, my dad also, he drank beer. My dad did not have an addiction. And so I wasn't threatened by alcohol at all. So when I said, hey, it was time for us to talk, questions such as, are you okay? Like, this was weird. You seem to be affected differently. And my former husband, he didn't have answers. It was just, he wasn't his dad, who was, before his sobriety, his dad was very angry and very abusive. And like, so it was difficult for him to pinpoint that this was a problem because it didn't look like what he grew up with.
Hmm. So what were you seeing that you wanted to talk to him about?
Well, my normal, mild-mannered, easygoing spouse, when he drank, it was like he became a different person. He became very withdrawn, untrusting, and he never was abusive. He never was threatening. There were a few times where he said some unkind things, but he was not calling me out my name or anything like that. But he would become unpleasant to be around and unkind and uninvolved, the complete opposite of who he was. Normally, he was the guy that volunteered at church. And if anyone called, he was there to show up. He was very generous. He was exceedingly likable and he was good at his job. He was just one of those general nice people. But Once he drank and the alcohol took effect, all of those positive characteristics would disappear.
Barb, I would think that would just be heartbreaking to see a man as loving and capable and outgoing as he was to turn into a little bit of a Jekyll and Hyde when he drank.
And that it took a few years for me to realize it was Jekyll and Hyde. It was always, his drinking was always secretive. Mm. It took me forever to actually realize that he was drinking. Even up until the point in 2018 when the girls and I had to move out of the house, he always kept it secret. It was always hidden. Alcohol was never in the open. It was very, very hard for me to even confirm or even confront. I remember there were the early years before Al-Anon where I would be searching all over the house going, I know I'm not crazy. I know that it's here somewhere. And because I didn't feel like I could have a conversation, keep having conversations about how it was affecting our lives if I didn't have any evidence. I didn't want to accuse him of something or the severity of it. And so that was crazy making for a while. It was absolutely crazy making. And having this really kind, lovely man who was just generous, my apologies, he was just generous and lovely, not having access to him at times, that about killed me. That just about killed me.
Well, it's kind of like there's another person in the relationship when the drinking or addiction takes hold, fair?
It felt as the years went on like it was an affair. That's how it felt. And by the time we had gotten to, it was right before our 20th wedding anniversary when the first separation happened. And he had lost his job, and I really thought I was going to die. I realized, and that was 2008, I was losing my husband to something that I couldn't see and I couldn't fight against. And I realized that it was owning him. And I just, like a person, I thought if it was at least another woman, I could go beat her up.
Yeah, go do business with her.
Yeah, I could do business with her. I could talk her out of it, like all the things. But addiction, I there wasn't anything I could do. And it was awful.
So, Barb, I'm starting to feel that there is hurt, pain, frustration, and maybe even some low-level anger going on with all that's happening, especially with the kids involved.
There was a lot of anger. Anger was probably the first in line because we had had what felt like a lovely life. And it wasn't perfect. I mean, we had our ups and downs. And my goodness gracious, I love Jesus, but I have my own problems. So I don't want to... when it comes to the struggles, addiction definitely was the cause of death. But we had other things in our, I mean, the kids didn't sleep sometimes, or there were just life things that we had to navigate. But I realized when anger really started to become uncomfortable for me, that's when I finally went to therapy. And this was actually a few months before the things broke open in 2008. I went to therapy because I just thought, I do not like how I'm managing myself. And this was long before any Al-Anon, long before I'm still working out the language here for husband, ex-husband, former husband. I'm still working all that out. But long before he ever went to AA, I went to counseling and I started going and kept going for 10 years. Because I realized ultimately all I had control over was me.
Yeah, and I don't even have that, right?
Barely, right?
But you're George Fraser.
Well, yeah, no, but that's a long learning curve, isn't it? So at first, did you think you were crazy?
There were times when I felt crazy, when I would come home from work and I would walk in and he would be different. And, or we would have these really awful arguments. And I'm scratching my head going, why am I fighting with him over this? This is not something we would fight about. And it took a long time for me to realize that he had been drinking. And I started during those early years, I was trying to bend myself inside out going, well, how do I fix myself so that we can stop this pattern of behavior? And it took a long time for me to discover that it was not actually about me.
And then that would have to hurt too, doesn't it?
It was a series of what I call funerals. I write about this and the things that I write about in my life. I began a process of having what I call my annual funeral. And this was just an intentional space and time when I would go down and to a beautiful park with a blanket, my journal, a Bible, and a pen. And it was a space of letting go and surrendering. I had to let go of the things that began happening in our lives, of these losses. They were piling up. And I didn't want the marriage to end, but we were accumulating a lot of heartache and a lot of hardship. And I realized that I couldn't keep holding on to it. And so I had to have a strategic process for letting it go because I did not want to be messed up. I watched some of what was happening in his extended family, of what happened when people would hold on to the poison that addiction gives. And I just thought, I don't want to end up like that. So I need help now in intentionally letting off those disappointments and resentments and anger. One of the big ones was our 20th wedding anniversary. I was so very, very angry at the end of that because something that I expected would happen didn't happen. And just, I was so brokenhearted, which turned to bitterness. And I thought, I have to let this go. When he went to AA in 2011 for the first time, he brought home the big blue book. And as he said, hey, you should probably read this. I'm reading it. And I said, great. So I grabbed it and started reading it. And it said that, and this was the old, old blue book, that 60% of marriages won't survive addiction. And it isn't always because the addicted person doesn't get sober. It's often because the other person actually tears up everything because they are still sick, even though the other person got better. And I made the decision that if I was going to pray and ask God to do a miracle, that I was going to do my part. And my part was finding ways to continue to discharge my anger and disappointment and fear and sadness.
All right, Barb, we're going to take a little break. Barb Roos is our guest tonight on Real Recovery. Thank you for listening. We're going to take 90 seconds and be right back. Welcome back to the show. Barb Roos is our guest tonight, and we are certainly enjoying her story, despite the fact, George, that it's already feeling painful and difficult.
Yeah, it's tough. These stories are always tough, but they have good endings, don't they?
Well, most of the time they do, and This is why we do Real Recovery, because we want to give people hope and let people hear about another person's journey and how they came and relied on Christ through all the storms of life. And Barb, one of the things you said in the last segment was how you would do a yearly funeral. That caught my attention. And it seems quite healthy that you're getting in a place and deciding to let things go. Boy, oh boy, that sounds like great advice.
It was life-giving and life-saving. I called it a funeral, but the counselor I saw at the time, he just said, you have to have strategic places in your life where you let this stuff go. And so there were years where I would do it twice a year. And I mean, I've been doing this for more than a decade now. And I most recently did it in August, just this year. And so I don't know if it's good to do it once a year or twice a year, or if it has to be every 3 months. I just know that I needed to be strategic about it. And the funeral itself, it's three parts. The first part is write down. The second part is, or I'm sorry, the first part is be real. The second part is write down. And the third part is release. And so the be real part is just getting really real before God and being honest about how the pain and the disappointment and the resentment. And the write it down is because once we write it down and we look at the words, we see the reality of it. It helps trigger other things in our memories that maybe were just stuck down there. Because when we don't let things go, that's what messes us up. That's what keeps us stuck. That's what slows our life down. And so writing is this kind of, it's purging, but it's bringing things up that we wouldn't otherwise acknowledge. And then the release, and the release is having to open up our hands and give it to God and say, you know, God, this wasn't what I wanted. This wasn't what I hoped for. What I dreamed isn't coming to pass. And yet I'm going to have to let some of these dreams die because I trust that you are greater and you can plant something better in its place. And I've experienced that in my life over and over again when I've decided to open up my hands and let go of what I was trying to hold on to. And the cost has been tremendous. And yet what God has given me has been worth it.
Do you think that all starts, no matter what the situation that we're disappointed in regarding God, that we have our own idea what should happen and God has another one? In that a lot of times our dreams were disappointed because our idea doesn't happen. But if God truly is in control, he allows these things to happen. And kind of instead of us giving it to God, really, it's us accepting that God has it already and we're going to go along with it. I made that more complicated than I wanted to, but.
No, I thought you nailed that because that is true. Our expectations, we know that God is capable of all things. We often create our own picture of how we think God should do things. I had a beautiful picture of how I thought that God would rescue and restore our family. I thought that God's glory would be for God to come in and take away the addiction, that we would do a couple of years of marriage counseling, and then we would be able to stand up a few years later and say, everybody, come listen to our story of what God did. Like, that's how I saw things happening. And things have happened completely different. But I had an observation, speaking of the funeral, in something that I had written recently, because it was an observation about the personal theology that I think that we don't mean to carry around, but we do. And that personal theology is that we pray and we God answers and then we live happily ever after. But what I wrote was, however, cemeteries are a reminder that God never wants us to dream of happily ever after while we're living on earth, because our broken, fallen world will rob us in that dream one way or another. Sometimes our waiting rooms and unexpected journeys are a setup for the better blessing that God wants to give us when he doesn't give us what we want. And I wrote those words this winter in this particular project while I was in the middle of an unwanted divorce. And I want to qualify that because those words are really easy to write when someone has gotten to the other side of something. But what I give thanks and glory to God to is that I can see that God is good because he is good, not because of my circumstances. And that even though he did not give me what I wanted, he has still given me better blessings that are eternal, that are life-giving to me now.
I love that.
That was beautiful, Barb.
And I think for me the key takeaway there is I need to focus on eternity rather than the here and now. And I want what I want, and I want it right now. And so that's hard for me. So that really ministered to me, so thank you.
And Barb, you wrote a book on I'm Waiting God, Finding Blessings in God's Delays. Now, you certainly were in a place where your faith must have felt challenged. You've got an alcoholic husband who is doing this Jekyll and Hyde If he lost his job, there's probably bills that are piling up, and the family feels stress, and the dreams that you have for the restoration don't seem to be happening. How did you feel in all of that?
So what I just read was from I'm Waiting God, and that was written, it came out in September. I wrote this winter while in the middle of the divorce. I absolutely did not want it. It was living conditions that it was no longer wise for us to remain in our home. And so my girls are all adults now, but we had to move out in July of 2018. I sat him down 110 days before and said, we do not want to do this, but this is where we're at. That was our third separation that was alcohol related. So there was an intervention in 2015, and he left the family for 5 months. He did not choose recovery. And then there was a short separation about 2 or 3 weeks in 2011 after a job loss. So there was a deep and great desire for all of us, including him. We didn't want our family to break up. Neither of us wanted to get a divorce. The conditions, however, dictated, based on the way that things were happening, we had to leave. It was no longer wise or healthy for us to remain in the home. And it was a few months after that that there were a series of events that happened that, to protect us all, including him, I had to go to an attorney, and the plan was just legal separation. I was trying to get some protection in place, and that in my state, that was not possible. In order to protect everyone financially, I had to file for divorce, and I had just been dragging my feet because I did not want it. And within a couple of months of it, even then, I sent a text message and just said he wasn't speaking to me, wasn't returning my text, and just said, I do not want to go through the divorce, but right now you're in bad shape and we need to protect us and the kids. And then it was a few months after that, he said, you know, I don't want to be married anymore. And the reality was that he hadn't wanted to be married for a while. We were holding on to commitment. We had made a commitment and we wanted to see that commitment through. It was a commitment I'd made to God 26 years before. We'd been in it and been through it. And the hardest thing in the world was being challenged with this idea of, am I going to attach God's glory to the outcome of my story, or am I going to live for God's glory no matter what happens?
That's a big thought. It's a brave thought. And I love that that's where you ended up, saying that you would live for him despite circumstances.
Yep. Easier said than done.
Oh,
too.
Boy, is that ever easier said than done.
But, you know, Bill, that has to be in your heart first in order to think it and say it.
Mm-hmm.
And so all those years of training spiritually to get closer to Jesus, you got to do that because the fire is going to come sometime in some form, and you're going to find out if you can stand, because this one hits you right at your core. And to have that thought, you know, you've spent some time in the Word and walking with the Lord to have that relationship with him.
Mm-hmm. Barb, you definitely have dealt with the need for patience. And you can always think in life that I wished I was a person that had more patience. And if you really pray that prayer, God usually gives you situations where you're required to find out what patience is. So I would love to hear what your thoughts are on patience.
This has been part of that patience journey. In the early days, I wanted to fix it, and I wanted to fix it now, because I like the life that we had and I wanted God to give us that life back. And when it felt like God wasn't moving at the speed I needed him to, I thought I would help him out. And that did not go well. I discovered that impatience is a key. One of those key things in life that undermines our relationships with each other. My inability to be patient and to allow my husband's spiritual journey to unfold. I know that that made some things very painful for him at one point. Like, he's responsible for his decisions, but there were many times where I would fuss and nag and all of those things because I wanted him to straighten up and fly right.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, patience has been about learning how to follow at God's speed and being willing. An old definition, that long suffering, like, we got rid of that word and we switched out patience, because long suffering, who wants that? So long suffering is that willingness to endure what God allows. And it's a journey, and it's a journey because there's no fast version. There's no fast way to it. Just this morning, I was praying for patience for something, because I need to remember that God has a plan and a purpose in all things. And I may not ever find out why or how God is doing something, but what I can do is I can let him lead. And I remember one of the best ways that manifested was when I did have to sit my husband down and say, you've got 110 days. And rather than just rashly putting a plan on the tracks and doing all the things, it was being willing to stay in a very hard environment for many more months and just say, God, I'm going to trust you in this period of time. I was led to a particular date on the calendar, and we had to grit it out. We had to grit it out. And the thing about it was that, as awful as it was, I remember I was dragging my feet on finding another place to live because I didn't want to have to go. And yet everything fell into place when that deadline hit, and there was no meaningful, at least there wasn't one, there was no meaningful step toward sobriety. Everything fell into place for what I had to do. Everything.
All right. Barb Bruce is my guest. We're going to take a little break. George and I will be right back with Barb in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. George, every time people hear this song, Cinnamon Girl, they know we're on our last segment. It's been a fascinating story with Barb Bruce tonight.
You know, we're talking about patience. I want to hear what happens.
I have no patience right now. Barb, you said everything fell into place. Tell me how God worked that out.
So the way that God worked that out, it was a 110-day timeline. At the time, our youngest daughter was a senior in high school. And I'd been praying for about 6 months saying, God, I do not know how we're going to keep doing this. Lord, I am watching and waiting for you to give me some wisdom. So what triggered it was an event that happened. It was an under the influence kind of event. So I prayed, I sat my husband down. I'd written everything out, and as compassionately as I could, said, this is what we're going to do. And June 1st was the deadline. And as we got through the spring, and I'm just begging every day, God, please get his heart. Please let him surrender, all of the things. So May happened, and I thought, oh no, I'm gonna have to look for something. And I wasn't in a big hurry. And I looked at one place and just was like, yeah, that's not right. And on June 2nd, there was a building in my neighborhood that we lived in for 20 years. I love my neighborhood. I kind of wanted to stay here. And a dear friend of mine from church, she and her husband owned a construction company. They had been renovating this building for 3 years. I live in a historical district. They happened to finish it that weekend. And I just walk over to celebrate with her. Yay, I'm so glad this worked. And as I'm standing in their show apartment, I just hear a voice that says, this is it. And I thought, oh no, God, I'm here to celebrate my friend. You still have to fix my family. And so I go home, I have to call her, and I have to explain what's going on in my family, which was painful and humbling. But the rent was exactly to the dollar what I could pay. Because I have to now, like, we have to split our household. Within just a couple of days, everything that we needed, from where to live, how we were going to, how the girls and I were going to navigate the move, people we needed to move. Everything fell into place within just a couple of days. I did not have to put together a plan. I didn't have to stress out about it. There were no questions about it. It just snapped into place, which is a lesson that I've learned about patience. Patience doesn't mean that there isn't hard work, but what patience and waiting on God's timeline means that there's no striving. There's no jamming square pegs into round holes. It is hard work, but it isn't heartache on top of trying to just force something to happen.
Barb, I would also venture to say that there were probably thousands of hours of prayer that had gone into that pivotal moment where you found yourself going to celebrate your friend, realizing that God was at work all along in helping you in your life.
All kinds of prayer, and not just my prayers, prayers of many, many people. Along this whole journey, there have been people walking beside me. In addition to going to counseling, I was in Al-Anon for many years. I went to Al-Anon, still go to Al-Anon, every single week that I am not traveling on the road. I never miss. I have an accountability partner that I meet with every other Wednesday for an hour. Never miss unless we're out of town. I have a group of friends who have just been committed for years praying for me through the season, plus the prayers of family. So it's not just my prayers, but it has literally been folks interceding. We interceded and said, God, save this family. Do not let this family break apart. And then the prayers for us as individuals, and then the prayers for just healing. All of us have had to grow through this experience because we wanted and believed that God could give us an outcome. And everyone who's prayed for us has seen the power of God at work, even in a story that turned out differently than expected. And so it's not just my story. This really is about God's glory.
Nice.
It is. I'm thinking a little bit about the experience your children had because they were younger when this was all happening. And I don't know if you feel like you're at liberty to talk about their experiences or if you want to leave it to them to one day share those. But when there is a person in the family that's driving the bus and he's an alcoholic and the bus crashes, everyone inside the bus gets rattled. How did they weather that storm growing up with Dad, who was not as present as he could have been?
It still is hard. Our oldest turned 27 in October. Our next was 24 and our last is 19. If I'm being completely honest, they knew more about their dad's drinking earlier than I did. He was not abusive, just he became very withdrawn. So they went from having a dad who was a coach, who took care of him when mom was traveling, who gave him baths every night and said prayers with him before they went to bed, to essentially a stranger. We're still dealing with that. The grief of that is tremendous, and each girl is handling it in her own way. One of them took herself to counseling and just said, this is just what I have to do. Another one, she has somewhat of a relationship. He has dropped his relationship with the kids. He'll text them every now and then, but two of our three kids, he has not actually seen face to face in almost, it's been over 15 months now.
Wow.
Is he sober?
No. He moved from our community about a month ago. He moved to a different city a few hours away. But one of the kids, we live 2 minutes from the house we used to own. We just recently moved. I just recently moved our stuff out. But he lived within 2 minutes of two of the three kids. Our oldest is an army officer. But He withdrew from all of our lives. I've only seen and talked to him a handful of times. He just is withdrawn from all of our lives.
It's so heartbreaking.
It is.
Yeah, I feel sorry for the family, and my heart breaks for him.
Yeah. I can't put words into his mouth. I don't know his story. I believe that the shame and the guilt, I know the man who he used to be, and I know that that it's got to be very, very hard. I think part of the journey of on my end of things, to learn how to forgive and to let go, what I've been blessed by is that it's allowed me to be compassionate, to be able to look at what the reality is on both sides and say, this is the circumstance where we're at, and I can forgive and I can pray for him every day for God's best, for freedom, for rescue, for restoration, and that it's important to me to pray for him each day, not because I'm a better person, but because I'm grateful that's what God has done in my heart, because this is not I pray that the story has a better ending than what we're seeing now.
Barb, if you have an opportunity now to speak to listeners who are in the middle of this chaos or in the middle of this fear or desperation, I would love for you to give them some of your beautiful coaching.
Well, I think the very first thing is that God is present.
Mm-hmm.
He is close to the brokenhearted. And I think that the hardest part when someone loves someone who is trapped in the cycle of addiction, whether it's a spouse or a child or just a friend, you don't think you can bear the broken heart. And some days you can't. And it's okay to admit that you can't. But God is near. He is right near. And then the second for me is to surround yourself with people who know how to walk with you through this. For me, that was an Al-Anon community that was vital.
You never isolated, did you? You never pulled away from people. You stepped into community, didn't you?
There is no other way to survive.
I thought that's what you were going to say.
Yeah, there was a, and for context for your audience, I was a teaching pastor for 10 years. I worked for my church for 14 years. And this kind of help was necessary for even someone in ministry, someone who knew the promises of God, knows the promises of God, still as much, I just said yes to everything that I could. And I had to make a decision a long time ago. I work for a mega church, and we got about 10,000 people who go to our church, and I was a teaching pastor. I had to make a decision that I was not going to care what other people thought, that other people's opinions were none of my business.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to make that decision so that I could get the help that I needed.
Okay. Barb, what a story. I so appreciate your courage and your patience and everything you've done to share your faith and hope with others. And you did it through the power of Jesus in your life, despite an outcome which was not what you desired. So it's a brave story.
It's a great story. God's story in us always is. Yeah. And thank you for sharing that with us.
Yes. Barb, thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah. I love the work that you do and the hope that you bring. God bless you.
Thank you so much. Barb Roos has been our guest. That wraps up our episode tonight. Thank you for listening and supporting Faith Radio always. George, say goodnight.
Good night, Bill.
Good night, George. Have a great night, everyone. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.